Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm really excited and also a little bit scared to host this topic tonight. This is one that I think will cut right to the heart of many of our listeners in your own particular journeys. I know lots of people who listen to this podcast are those who, for whom the Mormon story has become complicated. Perhaps a way of viewing Mormonism and understanding doctrines and what life was all about has somehow along the way become challenged. And for many, that's led them to really question about whether or not I can stay in the church or whether I can't. And one of the terms that we'll often hear, I think, on the podcast discussion communities is integrity, and it's an honoring of integrity that we want to talk about today, and we recognize that those who would come down on any position or any decision about this, that's something that's very important to them, that their integrity be held close to them. And so we don't want to say through this podcast that staying or leaving is the right answer. We want to talk about, in the fullest way possible, what integrity is, and especially when it comes to these decisions, just to put out on every possible angle that we can think of something about that decision, which isn't a very important one. We know it affects so many aspects of our lives as to whether to stay or go and remain connected with Mormonism. So with that in mind, I've got a wonderful panel. I have no doubt, whatever my fears are, that we have wonderful people to talk about this and to highlight and kick off a great discussion. Give it up. Joanna's back. We love to have you. Everybody's favorite guest and Joanna Books. The busy blogger.
I just have visions of the last time I saw David Lee Roth and if I could be that cool.
Anyway. Well, I think you are, and I'll tell you, you are the busiest woman in Mormonism these days, and we're grateful that you took the time to
That would
to
be my us. Relief Society president. But you know. Yeah, no, it's great to be here. I wasn't meaning to compare myself to David Lee Roth, except for that we're both aging and slightly washed up. But and Hessians at heart. So anyway, Dan, thank you for having me here. And I blog regularly at religiondispatches.org, and I also write the Ask Mormon Girl column, which you can find at askmormongirl.com or on Feminist Mormon Housewives. And always a pleasure to be with the OG, the Mormon Matters people.
All right. Thank you so much. And there's a million other things that we could put that you do, but everyone knows you. So we're glad to have you. Brian Johnston is back with us. Brian, thank you again. This is probably at least your fourth or fifth time on the show, and you're somebody whose insights I really value a lot. So would you mind everybody a little bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on again. Let's see, what do I do? I help run a site, stayLDS.com. I'm one of the people that runs that. I do podcasts, organize some events for the Mormon Stories community. I don't know, I guess I participate in a lot of different places. You can usually find me shooting my mouth off somewhere about Mormonism and religion, you know, and various groups, New Order Mormon, other places like that, so... Yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Awesome, and then you have family, and you have a real job too. So I know.
Oh yeah, yeah. In between all that, I have a family and a day job.
Yeah.
Brian is one of the ministering angels behind a lot of the projects that touch people's lives. So Brian is a good dude.
Totally.
I'm the shadow that lurks in the background of these projects.
No.
Step into the light, my friend. So we're glad to have you. Thank you for being on. And we're happy to welcome somebody whose name I know many, many of our listeners will know, but this is the first time he's been on the podcast, and that is Jeff Green. Jeff, in addition to maybe just sort of the bona fides of, you know, your involvement in Mormon, you know, online forums or whatever, why don't you give us a little fuller introduction to your life and work and all that stuff, and then if you don't mind sharing just a few minutes of your journey or whatever, too, that would sort of help frame your participation on the podcast.
Yeah, that would be great. First of all, I really appreciate the invitation to participate. These are some amazing people that I get to converse with today, yourself included, Dan. So really appreciate the invitation to participate. To give you a little bit of background on me, I come from many generations of Mormons. Three of my four grandparents are descendants of pioneers, including first wife of Brigham Young and friends of Joseph Smith. I lived in Utah until I was 10 years old and moved around a whole bunch after that. So I experienced Mormonism from inside Utah, outside Utah, and a whole bunch of different places. One of those places in high school, my closest friend would refer to me as the leader of the cult. So I've certainly...
what did that mean?
Whoa.
His affectionate way of saying Mormons are weird, and certainly my way of being okay with that is part of the reason I share that.
But, okay, cool.
I served a mission in California in the same area I actually live today. Went to BYU, studied English and accounting at BYU. I worked at the devotionals at BYU, so I attended almost every single devotional that I could while I attended there. As I mentioned, served a mission in California. After I returned home, taught at the MTC for 2.5 years, where I met my wife, and in fact, we were actually set up by missionaries.
Oh my God! I'm going to start a string of jokes. Jeff Green is so Mormon.
There you go.
Jeff Green is so Mormon. He met his wife at the MTC. I love it.
I actually, to add to that list, I taught in the CES program briefly.
Oh, yeah.
I was Elders Quorum president. And up to about 18 months ago, I was on the High Council. And then started reading a whole bunch and eventually decided to basically resign from the High Council out of a matter of integrity. So that's kind of where I sit on my faith journey. You'll hear lots more of my perspective later. In terms of the rest of my life, I'm the CEO of a small 25-person advertising company that has offices in New York and Southern California, so I split my time between the two of those. And I have a wife and three kids, so excited to be here.
Very good, and we're excited to have more of your journey unfold as we go. So you guys, we're going to call, I don't know what I'd labor this, it'll be something along, you know, lines of a matter of integrity or something. And if you don't mind us getting started, it seems to me there's lots of different incarnations or different ways that people will phrase this when they'll say, the reason for my decision to stay, the reason for my decision to go, the reason for my decision to take some time off and think about where I am in my journey, and maybe that's closest where you are right now, Jeff. They'll often say it's a matter of integrity, but they'll phrase it different ways. What are some of the ways that you encounter those besides just the word integrity, which generally means consistency in the way I act, sort of a marriage between my ideals and my actions and things like that. So integrity is one of these words, but there's other ways to phrase it. Does anyone have one that they can come up with that is another way people will phrase that?
I guess I'll give a stab at it. Actually, integrity in particular seems to be a word that's thrown around a lot, but not very well defined all the time.
Good. So define it more.
Well, I agree with you, Dan, when you said it's. I think it indicates a consistency of thought and a consistency of action. There's a couple other words I think are related, and all these sort of cross over at different times. There's authenticity, integrity, and honesty. And I think sometimes the use of those gets kind of blended together all into this one word, integrity. So, yeah, like you said, I think there's a consistency of a thought that's associated with integrity and action. And authenticity, I think, relates more to like the inside, what's going on inside you and how that conflicts with external pressures and demands to live or act a certain way. And then honesty just being like the level of truthfulness, whether you answer questions truthfully or you see things truthfully, that kind of thing. Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
I would add that for me, integrity actually can be measured as the delta between what we value and how our lives reflect what we value. So a lot of times it's more than something that's just binary. We have a tendency to want to make things into something binary. Either we have integrity, we don't. Either we have honesty or we don't. But the truth of the matter is nobody's honest 100% of the time. Nobody has integrity 100% of the time. There is a delta between what we value and how our lives reflect those values. And it's just how much of that and how much of that is acceptable, where we sometimes draw the line between having integrity and not.
Excellent. Joanna, any thoughts on defining the term or how people use that in conversation when they're explaining to you their reasoning regarding maybe perhaps a change in their status with the church?
I'm still going to listen for a bit. You know, I told Dan at the outset of this that I'm very interested in this discussion. I'm very supportive of this discussion, but I'm coming at it from a slightly different angle, in that integrity hasn't been personally one of the main frameworks for my own faith crisis or faith transition. You know, I know people for whom it has, and I have some thoughts and theories and things I'd like to tease out as we get the ball rolling. But I'm still listening right now.
Well, let me go. What I was fishing for, and let me just, maybe I'll start the ball rolling, is instead of somebody maybe not always using the word integrity or something, they'll say to my, you know, as I encountered these things, I came to realize that the church isn't what it claims to be. It claims to be the one and only true church, and I no longer feel that that's true. It claims to be led by divine prophets, and yet I'm seeing a lot of these guys acting a lot like very fallible human beings, and I can't mesh that, and they kind of put it in a binary all or nothing terms, and so I need to leave, I need to withdraw somehow or other. Those are the types of things I'm doing. So I know there's other phrases out there, and I'd rather have you guys come up with some. I've made a list too, but what would be some other ways that you hear people who are wrestling with this decision? What would they say?
Well, in a broad general context, there was another issue with integrity that I've thought about, and one of them has a lot to do with the context, and this is where sometimes integrity is poorly defined. I was thinking of an example like where you throw a criticism at like an enemy. You say like, "Oh, terrorists have no integrity because they do bad things," where from the perspective of the victim, you're trying to say that those people are evil, bad people. But, you know, in the context of the people on the other side, this enemy, they actually have integrity. They're so committed to what they're doing, they'll fly an airplane into a building.
Yeah, so they have integrity with their own belief. Yeah, right.
Right. It just doesn't happen to jive with your belief that people shouldn't do that. So, like, that's just one of those issues where I think something that complicates the matter is how context and perspective affects a judgment of what has integrity and what doesn't.
Cool.
I was just going to add to your list. And basically, I think terms like the church isn't what it claims to be, the church isn't honest, the church hasn't been open or transparent, or the church hasn't shared the whole truth as it relates to the history, I feel betrayed. I think all of those concepts are often substitutes for lack of integrity. And so integrity becomes an issue around all of those items.
And this is kind of where I'd like to start, just, you know, entering sort of in active listening mode, if I could. And, you know, Jeff, I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit, if it's okay.
Sure.
And you'll tell me if it's not. So when someone, because the path I took, and, you know, and just for those who don't know, you know, my issues with the church were cumulative, but they were largely, I would describe them as ouch issues rather than, you know, integrity issues, that I just couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take anti-feminism. I couldn't take anti-gay activism directed by the church, and it was just too painful. And I took a six or seven year sabbatical, and have recently come back into moderate activity. I hold a calling, but I'm not the Mormon I once was as a young thing. But so when I hear other people talk about this sense of betrayal, tell me what that means. Like, and I'm not querying its realness. I'm just saying you feel like individually you were lied to by people who were presenting, or that people have presented this literal case, you know, version of Mormon history and of Mormon truth claims, and that you at some point were enlisted into also, you know, making those truth claims. You were kind of taught to make those truth claims and rewarded for bearing your testimony a certain way, and then enlisted sort of as an agent of spreading those truth claims. And then at some point you start to do the reading and you're like, oh, holy moly, it's not literal. And the correlated version isn't the whole story. And I've been duped, and my trust has been abused by the institution. Is that the process? Is there something I'm missing?
No, I think that I think you've got it summarized. To just express it perhaps a slightly different way, I think that often within the church, we talk about the values of being honest and truthful. And in preparation for this, I was looking at the Gospel Principles Manual on the lesson in honesty. And, you know, you look through that really quickly and you'll see headlines that say, to lie is dishonest. We must not excuse our dishonesty. We can be completely honest. Those are three of the five headlines for the lesson on honesty.
Right.
So when you have those sorts of ideals and you believe that Mormonism incorporates the whole truth, that Mormonism is looking for all truth, no matter where we may find it. You know, you can find countless examples of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young making those sorts of claims and statements. But then when you find out that actually the correlated version of our history is very one-sided, and that not all truth is, quote, useful, you find out that, oh, wow, I've actually only heard the defense's case in this trial, and the prosecution has some very damning evidence, when I thought that actually the church was judge and jury, not the defense attorney. And so the fact that the roles have changed so substantially in this court case makes you feel a little betrayed or question the church's integrity on some level, because the values that they promote, and again, I look at integrity as the delta between the values that we speak of and promote and how much our lives reflect those values. And as a result, hypocrisy is the opposite of integrity. So
it's sort of premised on a worldview or on an understanding or a belief that, I mean, where a crisis of faith that's framed around sort of truth issues and integrity is based on is this kind of notion that the institutional church is obliged to tell rigorously, you know, factual truths and to hold to those, and that it's special in this way.
Yeah, well, I'd add in, I mean, certainly a common theme in the Mormon narrative is that there was special truth restored. That's right. That's what we have. That's, you know, as missionaries, and, you know, I served a mission too. You know, I dedicated 2 years to my life of going out and trying to convince people that we have this special truth that nobody knows.
Brian,
you know? So, yeah.
Here's my pet theory, and I'm just going to throw it out there to the Mormon Matters community. I think this is a gendered thing. Listen to the gut check. No, I mean, I'm not going to generalize. I'm not going to universalize. But I think that the experience of being on a mission for 2 years as an emissary of the church and making tremendous sacrifices to do extremely hard, unforgiving work, knocking doors, and, you know, we'll bring the world his truth, shapes faith transition and crisis for men in a very particular way.
I don't deny that. No, I think you have a very good observation.
And why? What is it about women that maybe it doesn't frame it?
We didn't have to do.
Way?
I mean, some of us did that.
Oh, I see. Okay,
so
a sister missionary would. It's not the question that she would still process it differently. It's those who go versus don't go.
I'm not saying universal. I'm saying it's an observation. It's a suspicion. You know, that the experience of proselytizing and being an emissary for this, you know, being really on the line, you know, in physically uncomfortable, even dangerous situations, door to door, extremely vulnerable at this pivotal point in your life, when you were sent out to soldier, right? You know, and I wasn't. partly because of my own choice, there are women who were. And so I think that experience shapes faith crisis a different way for men.
So I would agree that gender plays a substantial part in the way that this discussion gets shaped. However, my wife, who also served a mission, has approached this faith crisis very differently, even though she has, you know, been out proselyting, knocking on doors. In fact, because she served foreign, she probably taught less and contacted more than I did. But I think to some extent it may come down to females often value the community and the experience
yep.
far more than males. And for me, I would say that some of the painful moments that I've experienced inside of Mormonism, including on my mission, but particularly after my mission, and some of the tough glances I got into church politics and those sorts of things, made it so that I would say often, in fact, thousands of times to myself throughout my Mormon experience, man, this is ridiculous to think that the true church has this in it. It's really unfortunate that people behave this way, or that so-and-so made this decision, but thank God it is true. I wouldn't put up with this if Joseph Smith weren't a prophet, if the Book of Mormon weren't true. And I basically put more and more pressure over time on those truth claims.
Awesome.
Oh, boy. Yeah. And so truth salved for you the shortcomings of community. You were willing to overlook the shortcomings of community because you felt there was truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
fascinating.
Yeah.
I'll give you
one example there. Early in my faith crisis, I brought up some of my concerns about tithing to my bishop. And basically, I felt like there was a little bit of hypocrisy in the church by them asking me to give a full accounting of my financial donations for a year, and that I couldn't expect the same from them in return. And I have an amazing bishop, a fantastic bishop, who had no idea how to respond to my sort of pointed inquiry. And he knew, though, that this was a serious issue for me. So clearly he thought about it. And after a week of thinking about it, he came back to me and said, hey, I'd like you to give a talk in church on the benefits of tithing. And thinking that research would put me in the right place. And I was sort of uncomfortable with the way the church conducts finances, even at that time, but I agreed to do it. And basically, my talk consisted of, hey, there are some benefits to tithing, and it certainly helps. But the bottom line is this. If Joseph Smith is a prophet, if the Book of Mormon's true, if this is God's church, we should pay tithing. So I think that's really what it boils down to.
Terrific.
Jeff, I'm so grateful to get to know your story better, you know, and the way that truth claims, you know, function for you. Is this a way of negotiating, navigating, or staying the course, maintaining a level of commitment to an organization that reveals itself to be imperfect? You know, I'm wondering, though, like, what are the grounds, if we take away truth claims, the idea that there are even absolute truths that can belong to any organization, you know, what are some renegotiated grounds for which someone could then deal with an imperfect community? You know, and I'm just thinking of back when I was at BYU and I was in a feminist, I was in Cecilia Farr's feminist home evening, which also convened on Monday night, sort of like our podcast sometimes does. And a woman named Marnie Asplin Campbell, who some of our listeners may know because it's a small Mormon world, was, you know, she was clearly one of the wiser people in the group. And, you know, being sort of in the throes of my own feminist struggle with the church and its doctrine and the community, I didn't quite get what she was saying, but she would kind of calmly reiterate the point that, you know, that there's not one organization or body or community that we can belong to that doesn't involve some sort of, you know, compromise of principles. You know, whether that's the bank you patronize or the nation you belong to. You know, and I'm thinking of the experience that we talked about, this missionary experience of going out and putting yourself on the line and then continuing it in adulthood, you know, and men carry in our church, for better or worse, a different set of responsibilities and are called to kind of publicly vouch for and declare, even in a, I think maybe even a different rhetorical style in testimony meetings, declare, I know, in certain ways. Right. There's a lot of social credibility given to that. Women, we can just go cry about stuff. That's fine. But it's sort of like being a veteran who went and fought for the U.S. and then coming back and going to college and realizing that not only was the U.S. not the home of the free and the land of the brave, but that it actually was a nation with a genocidal history, a deeply racist history, an imperialist present, a nation where there was an extreme inequality of wealth, you know, and the feelings that that person might feel, you know, in discovering that these commitments, these sacrifices they'd made were not for the reasons that they thought, were not what they'd been taught they were. You know, and actually, what does a person do at this, that point? You know, what does any of us who's a citizen of the U.S. do when we go to college and realize, you know, it's not what we were taught when we were little? Do we leave the country? You know, what are the bases for integrity as a citizen, and how do those translate or not to the church? And I know reasons why they don't, but I'm interested in working those through out loud.
Yeah. One immediate reaction, and then I'd love to hear from Dan and Brian, but I like the analogy, and especially the war vet. In some days when I returned home from my mission, I definitely felt that way in a number of ways. But in one way that the church and America are very different is that America is a place for dialogue. America is a place for a free market.
Oh,
no, come on. Supermajority is the only way to get anything done in Congress now.
But what I mean by that is contrast the freedom of speech with it is wrong to criticize your leaders of the church, even if the criticisms are true. Of course, a quote by Dallin H. Oaks. It's easier for there to be a delta between the values and the truth claims that we have in the church than there is in America, because we have such incredibly high ideals.
There you go.
The only reason that Dallin H. Oaks can make a claim like that is because he can say, I am a prophet of God and I communicate directly with God. So, I mean, basically it boils down to either you have to be open to discussion or you have to be right all the time because you commune with God. And when you make a statement like we're not willing to really have discussion, whether that's on truth claims or any other matter, you sort of have to be right. And so if you come at this from an angle of we're making really bold assertions that we're the only true and living church on the face of the earth, the only one with whom the Lord is well pleased, we have to live up to that or we have to stop saying that in order to maintain integrity.
Mm-hmm. I get that. And so do you automatically feel, and I agree with everything you said, but here's an interesting question to me. So do you automatically feel that the leaders of the church, do you feel an identification, a sense of automatic identification with church leadership? Like when you say we, like you use we in a lot of that sense, like you're like, you know, if we're going to go around claiming that we are the only true church, we've got to act like it. Who's we?
Oh, that's a great question. And I'm perhaps conflating individuals there, right? But I think it's hard to make the case that any specific sort of run-of-the-mill Mormon, or that the average Mormon, doesn't have a high degree of integrity. So when I talk about we, I am specifically talking about the leadership of the church. Mm-hmm. So I think that, and when I say leadership, I mean Salt Lake leadership. That anybody that claims to be a prophet, seer, and revelator, I think has a higher standard to live by. Because again, what we value and what we promote versus how our lives reflect that. And when you say I'm a prophet, seer, and revelator, and I can't be criticized, that's a really high bar to live up to, that I don't think individual members of the church are making that claim or assertion.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's address that later on. I think that'll come up towards the end of the podcast, at least as I've got things laid out. Brian, did you want to jump in on anything before I kind of steer us back to a couple of places I wanted to go?
Yeah, actually, you know, you guys had brought up that vet, you know, veteran issue, and this is actually something that I had to work through before I had a Mormon faith crisis. I had a military faith crisis.
Interesting.
Yeah. So right after I got off from my mission, you know, I got married right away, had a family, doing the whole Saturday's Warrior, you know, got to bring spirits into the world, and then realized I had actually no education and no career skills and anything like that. A big surprise. Yeah, there, a pot of gold didn't end up at the end of the rainbow. So I ended up joining the Army and ended up going into Army intelligence, and I spent 4 years on active duty, and I was also spent a little bit of time in the reserves. And during that time, you know, I was somewhat, you know, only a couple of years out of being a missionary, out of the mission frame set, you know, of everything about being truth, you know, preaching truth and fighting for truth, and then, you know, go right into this other context that has a lot of parallels to being a missionary, you know, wearing a uniform, you know, it's just green instead of a suit and a tie, and a very structured lifestyle. But the particular field I was in military intelligence was also very pumped up with ideals, you know, and had a very high level top, you know, had a very high level security clearance, worked over in Korea, and really had a lot of struggles seeing untruthful things said, you know, like being on the other side of collecting the story and then seeing how the story is presented, had a lot of issues related to the same kind of thing that, you know, I hear a lot with a disaffection process in the LDS church. And I have to say that this is influenced slowing down my decision when I went through a religious faith crisis, because when my military faith crisis, I actually did write a resignation letter and left that over that issue, resigned from, you know, the job I was in, and pretty much made it so I would never have a security clearance again. Not that I did anything wrong. It was just, I said things in a way that, you know, look, I don't believe in this. I think there's a lot of lying going on and people's lives are at stake. And sometimes I regret that. And that affected how I looked at things, you know, many years later. Mm-hmm. But so many parallels. It was just unreal.
Brian, if you don't mind me asking a follow-up question, what about it do you regret? Because I think maybe there's some insight in those details.
Well, I saw it very black and white at the time. You know, and like I said, we were very pumped up with all these ideals, you know, defending the United States, and we're always the good guys, and we're protecting freedom, you know, for people in other countries. And then you kind of see how things really happen, you know, like it's a lot of the details I can't really go into, but it just, the reality of what happens in the background is not always all Yankee Doodle Dandy and heroes flying in, you know, and saving people. It's just a lot of ugly business. And I've seen, you know, I saw people just flat out lying who were in positions of authority. And
but maybe Jeff was getting at her. What was the details of your regret?
Oh, my regret.
That maybe then changed how you dealt with your faith crisis in terms of, I don't want to regret the way I regretted then.
Precisely.
Yeah, okay. So I went into it very just black and white the way I saw it, and I think I could have done better if I had stayed involved, or I have these like second thoughts about it, or maybe I should have stayed in that as a career, but the way I exited out of it made it so that I could never use any of those career skills, or
guns,
you know, I burned the bridge. You know, I didn't just say, yeah, you know, I'm just not going to reenlist. Maybe I'll check out you guys later.
And better for who? Better for you? Or if you would have sort of left them in a more nuanced way and left some doors open, or better for the military? Like, better for who?
It would have been better for me if I'd done it in a more nuanced way.
Right.
I wouldn't make any, there's, you know, I don't have any grandiose ideas that I would have changed the entire United States Army or anything.
Right.
You know, but.
Well, because I think, you know, one of the consequences of Mormonism having a lay priesthood, and Jeff, I'd be interested in hearing you kind of reflect on your experience in this regard, is that, you know, again, this may be a gendered thing, but it seems to me like we are more likely to think of Mormonism as something that we are entirely responsible for. Like, if something is decided in Salt Lake that we do not like, we are responsible. And sometimes we are responsible for implementing things that, you know, kind of stir against our conscience. you know, especially people who hold the positions of priesthood leadership, you know, and that sense of group ownership versus a sense of, oh, this is my religion. It's supposed to sort of give me something. It's sort of be a resource to me. I think, you know, there's a very active, very proprietary sense of the whole institution that, you know, some of us and maybe men in particular carry that makes integrity feel like a very salient concept.
I think you're absolutely right that there's a sort of cultural aspect to this that makes it so that we feel a sense of loyalty. And I do think that there's lots of correlations to the military, that we are the armies of God. And whether you're talking about missions, and actually the first thing that came to mind was mission numbers and remembering how uncomfortable I felt with that. And I felt the same thing when I was Elders Quorum president and focused on home teaching numbers and in this machine that is Mormonism, there is a sense that do your duty, which is perhaps the most common theme in, you know, the priesthood session of conference, do your duty. It definitely has a cultural impact on sort of owning the whole of it, as you put it.
Mm-hmm. You didn't know this show, Dan. You didn't know the show was going to be about men, faith, crisis.
that's right. I am going to step in and do a little steering there, but one thought that I did have on this gendered thing, I think it's a terrific insight. And when Jeff mentioned his wife's way of processing sort of the same question that he's going with, it reminded me a lot, and Joanna, you're probably aware of this, and some of our listeners are, and it might be worth looking up, Lawrence Kohlberg at Harvard about decision-making processes. And then his own student, Carol Gilligan, came along and says, you know,
that's right,
men and women do differently. Men are much more, so besides just being out on the front lines and doing battle, and I stuck my neck out for these truth claims, men just more naturally say, here is the truth. It is clean. It is clear. You know, sort of this platonic way that you can sort of know this pure truth. And then they make decisions based upon that, where for women, at least Carol Gilligan came along and says, you know, it's more of an enmeshed set of relationships that are at the top of our thing. And so where he has an ethics of justice, her language is that women naturally seem to fall more into an ethic of care. And an ethic of communion with each other. And so anyway, that just adds a little bit of breadth to what I think is a terrific insight. So does that, anything more on Gilligan or Kohlberg that you'd want to say, Joanna?
No, that's really useful. And, you know, just to keep it for just a second, we don't have to stay here very long, you know, shift it out of gender and just think too, you know, because I think the issue of truth and what is a truth claim is so important. You know, I think, there's a notion implicit in the language we're using that comes from early modern philosophy. And when I'm talking about early modern, I mean like Renaissance or like Descartes, you know, this notion that there is the subject who knows things. And then there's Kant,
right,
who extends that idea to there is the subject who knows things. And those notions and the way that they're enacted in the universe are the basis for sort of categories of behavior that should be implicitly universal, right?
Exactly.
Right, this making, you know, the idea that knowledge is ethical. So, you know, if you know something, it obliges you to a course of action, obliges everyone. If something is knowable, then everyone should, you know, assent to it. And then we get to the late 20th century, and thinkers like Foucault just say, the French philosopher Fouquet say, no, we don't come into this world in charge of knowledge at all. In fact, knowledge precedes us, and it gets just programmed in. He uses the word discourse, and we just get stewed in it. We just get stewed in this discourse until, you know, until we're grown. And when we're grown, we may have a fantasy of breaking out of it or mastering this discourse. But we're just sort of stewed in this discourse. And for Foucault, discourse is both a set of ideas and a set of institutions, right? So we are stewed up in Mormonism, and you know, and so for me, as someone who's kind of thought through or studied through these different ways of understanding the human relationship to truth, where Foucault comes finally is the place where, well, you know, the point is to the search for meaning. It's not absolute truth, because that's a fiction. That's a fiction that there is an absolute truth. It's a search for meaning. And, you know, Foucault says the most fascinating thing. He says, truth is the history of an error, right? So we're right, born into these totally screwy cultures, and, you know, each one in its own particularly delicious and inspiring way, you know, peculiar. And for us, it's Mormonism. And the best we could do from a Foucauldian or postmodern point of view is to make meaning up, to find what is meaningful and beautiful in it. And for me, that that shift, which, you know, thank heavens I had my faith transition in graduate school so I could read a lot of stuff while I was at it that helped me think through the process of what it means to know. It really worked for me, you know, as just a shift from the pressure we carry of, you know, being raised in a culture that values the very literal, the most literal accounts of who we are, and sort of taking a step back and saying, yeah, it is really messy. And it's not just messy for Mormons. It's messy for everybody. It's messy for everyone, this search for meaning. And integrity then, you know, as I came out the other side of it, I guess became a way of how honorably do you play the set of cards you're dealt.
Ooh, I love that. Thank you. And
yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, when you said you were grateful it happened in grad school for you, I've been grateful for that too with me when, you know, basically my whole life was centered around these quests. And I know it's so much more difficult when you're dealing with it along with everything else and your full-time job, so to speak, isn't to wrestle with this. And so,
yeah.
More power to everybody who's doing it, you know, that way. So the gendered thing, thank you. I'm so excited. That was a total unexpected present to this discussion that I'm grateful that we have. Here's where I want to steer. It seemed to me that, Jeff, a lot of things you were saying, and Joanna was drawing you into conversation about this too, was sort of about the integrity of the church itself, whether the church is acting, you know, with integrity, you know, and its honesty with tithing, you know, or its own finances or whatever. Whereas I guess I had imagined this podcast more on the individual listener saying, how do I act with integrity? You know, the other question is important. Is the church having its own integrity and acting out of integrity is an important one. But I kind of wanted more of the focus to be on my decisions, that they're with integrity. So if, do you mind us shifting back to that?
I don't mind at all, and I think they're both interesting questions, so I think there's a lot we could talk about with the individual.
And I think in the third section, at least as I outlined it for you guys, I really think we can get back into where the interplay of the church's own integrity can come back into place. But I kind of want to still hear out some of the ways I've heard this phrase, so let me just go ahead and throw some out as a way of kind of moving us along. If I stay in the church, it implies that I tacitly consent to all the things the church does. It means, for me to stay in the church, means that I am complicit in the pain and heartache caused to my gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, intersex friends. You know, to stay means I give consent. And so some people will argue the integrity thing, or that will be the button that pushes them over. Have you guys heard that before?
Yes.
Okay, so yep. Another one
yep,
would
many
be,
times.
The other one would be is, and maybe this one, I'll just personalize this one by saying, in my in the interview that I did with John DeLynn, where he was, you know, pumping me on everything, I kind of use the analogy of, you know, my integrity says that I need to see not only my integrity says, yes, I have to see the cat crap that's in the sandbox, but I've also got to see the sand. I've got to be able to look at both sides. But someone came...
Now that's some elegant...
Yeah, well, it is. It is. But somebody came along and said, you know, at a certain point, Dan, you know, as I think it was in the conversation online after it, so much cat crap makes a toxic environment. You know, even though, yes, there is lots of sand there, somehow or other, I don't want my children playing in that sandbox. And so a lot of the times I hear this articulated in terms of my children. I'm trying to protect my children from ideas that then they have to have, you know, be deconstructed and rooted out of them later in life. Or I'm trying to protect my children from some of this heartache and pain that I'm going through right now. And so their integrity questions, a lot of times I'm hearing it framed in terms of, I want better for my children.
Yeah, that's a really tough topic.
Okay. So then the another one, then certainly an area that comes up a lot to me is in that Temple Recommend interview sort of thing. It says, you know, a lot of people will say, it takes once you've had this faith crisis, once your eyes have been open, it takes a lot of mental gymnastics for you to say yes to the Temple Recommend questions. And so they'll say, you're not acting with integrity if you're aware of all these things and you still say yes, 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 or at least give all the proper answers. I don't know if all the answers are yes.
If nothing else, you're answering, you might be answering in a way that you know the person asking the question isn't, might not be thinking of
Exactly. Well, that's the second half. Yeah. So the first half is you've had to go through all this crazy mental gymnastics to say yes. So really, you're not even being integrous with your own brain. But then the second half is exactly what you're saying, Brian, here. Therefore, for you to give the yes answers or the appropriate answers, you're using doublespeak. You're saying one thing to them because that's the expected answer, or that makes for the smoother discourse, when inside you have so much more to say that you're withholding. So can you see that? That's why I was trying to separate those two things.
Sure.
So I've heard it both ways. I think most people, it's like anything that you have to go through this many, you know, gyrations in your own brain, and you have to redefine this and redefine that and, you know, pull back on all that stuff, they'll just say that's just a crazy process to have to go to.
But here's my question. Is any of this special to Mormonism? I mean, there's an aspect in what Jeff said about the churches, at least the contemporary churches, we've experienced it. Its allergy to robust open dialogue in official settings. Okay, that may be specific to Mormonism, but is any of the rest of it, like toxicity in human environments, concerns about passing on the weaknesses of a culture to children, like is any of, you know, is this, it's, it may be, is any of this special to Mormonism?
I don't see that it is, and that's usually one of the arguments that I use to kind of to argue in the other direction with that. This to me, when I had to sort this out on the religious level, it seemed to me really not to be a whole lot different than what I had to do at work, what I had to do in the military, what I had to do to keep my marriage peaceful, you know.
No, that's a good one.
I mean, it really comes down to this, you know, this thing, authenticity. It's the conflict between what's going on inside you and your personality and your personal preferences versus expectations, external pressures to conform to something else. And it's a balancing act. I don't think it's one way or all the other way. It's not you're completely authentic or you're completely inauthentic. You're constantly making a judgment. Do I sacrifice my feelings and preferences in order to have a slightly more comfortable relationship with the people around me that I need for either survival or a happy life? Or am I going to just let myself be free and, you know, everyone else, to heck with them. They'll just have to accept me the way I am. You know, I think it's a sliding scale, you know, and it's a decision we make in all kinds of different contexts and relationships.
So the one thing that I would add that makes it a little bit more unique is that, at least according to the claims of Mormonism, your salvation is at stake, right? So as Brian, as you're navigating what to do with the military and what not to do, and do I resign and do I not resign? You know, that has impacts, some substantial impacts on your life and career options and things like that. But as you consider the same decisions inside of Mormonism, and particularly when we're talking about things like the Temple Recommend interview, those things are related to your salvation, and eternity is a very long time. So when in at least that one aspect, the stakes are much higher here than they are in any other organization. And perhaps the claims are slightly more bold here than they are in any other organization.
Yeah, and I've often heard it's, you know, within religion, you're making extraordinary claims.
Yeah.
So you need to have extraordinary truthiness.
If you buy, I mean,
Stephen Colbert.
If you buy into all of that, you know, I mean, and I think, you know, I certainly don't want to underestimate that people need to do what they need to do to protect their souls, and especially if they just can't abide the kind of very difficult balancing act you talk about, or if they're, you know, I took a sabbatical. I mean, if you're in a position where you're trying to salvage yourself and get a sense, you know, after your trust in an institution has been shaken and sort of reconstitute a sense of yourself in relationship to God, that it's helpful to sort of do that outside, to sort of disentangle or disidentify yourself for a while from this strongly institutional worldview. I mean, and it's interesting because as I was struggling with it all, that's where some of the most fundamental teachings of Mormonism that weren't about hierarchy came back to me, which was prayer, you know, the love of God. And these are not unique to Mormonism. You know, the truth claims of Mormonism are unique to Mormonism, but, you know, this view that, you know, God loves their children, basically, served as an asset to me. And I suppose, Dan, this just goes back to the relational framework, but an asset to me in saying, you know what, I can hold the truth claims in front of me in my hand and honor their weight, and yet there's something bigger that's holding me, and it's not the institution.
Joanna, as you were talking, that that just reminded me of the dialogue that's going on in my head a lot lately as I go to church and try to navigate, you know, just my own decisions. And the notion of a sabbatical is definitely what I feel like I'm doing right now, which is creating some amount of distance between me and the church. And for me, the right thing, and particularly when I separate myself from all the anger and all the emotion and even identity issues that you're addressing as you go through a faith crisis, that ultimately I want to come to peace with Mormonism. And that will only happen as I create the right amount of distance. And you also touched on something in that is sort of the core of the issue, which is because the truth claims or the major claims of Mormonism that make it distinct from others, namely priesthood, the only true church, the first vision, the historicity of the Book of Mormon, because those are promoted with such regularity and such a huge percentage of the content at church contains those things, can I have integrity? Can I be authentic if I don't share that? And can I be quiet and still participate in the things of Mormonism is sort of the outstanding question as I create that distance or undergo that sabbatical.
See, and this is so interesting and helpful to me because now I hear then the concern with integrity as sort of in a very particular context. And this makes sense in what I've experienced in people's faith transitions, that integrity really comes into play in that moment when people are trying to get free from a culture that demands the regular performance of a very specific kind of orthodoxy and assent, right? Like, people are just trying to engineer some space where they don't have to go and say that anymore, and so that they can figure out what it is they can say. And integrity comes in, and it's a value. It's an LDS value. Honesty is an LDS value. That then, you know, people say, I can't do this with integrity anymore. But really, it's gesturing beyond that, because Jeff, you know, your description just opens up. Like, I just need this sabbatical. I need this space. It just becomes sort of a human rights issue, you know, rather than this sort of abstracty truth claim thing. It's about the condition of the soul. Like, the soul needs space. You know, sometimes the soul can't be in that context anymore. And the soul needs space in order to grow in the ways it's going to grow next, you know. And that's where your story then becomes less abstract and about truth claims and more about you're continuing to grow, right? And the integrity factor, you know, is crucial, but it was a way that you could say to the institution in language that it could understand, I can't do this anymore.
That's right.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. That's wonderful to point out. Let me do this. Here's listeners, here's how we had planned to structure this. And I think we can get past at least one of the sections fairly quick. I wanted to have everyone be assured that everyone on this podcast believes that there are legitimate reasons for some people to leave the church, that no one would claim that people don't have integrity if they choose to leave the church. So just as a way of, instead of making that its own section, would each of you panelists sort of say that in a way that you would, if you were to talk to somebody who says, I just can't do it anymore, that you would at least assure them that you honor that as a possible choice that is very much full of integrity, but also kind of give a flavor for when you think that's probably perhaps the right choice versus perhaps it just is sabbatical or something. Does that make any sense if I frame that okay? Am I asking you guys to do something you're comfortable with?
Oh, yeah.
Like Brian, so when you're wrestling with somebody and you're in the stayLDS.com, so there is a little bias there that you want people to stay if they can do it. Why is it that you want them to stay, but when is it that you communicate with them, or when is it you really see in your heart that, boy, it probably was best for this person to step away?
Yeah, now, I do kind of go out of my way to put that challenge out there sometimes for people to say, to stay, but I do want to put in that disclaimer, like, stayLDS.com is not convincing everybody to stay. It's if you have decided you would like to stay and make something useful out of it, here's a community of people you can talk to who kind of do this. So if you want that, here's some help. But on a regular basis, as a matter of fact, every day, my wife is somebody who's left, and she has perfectly rational, logical reasons with a lot of integrity why she made the decision to have permanent distance. And I got another friend here in the ward, you know, somebody I talk to quite often who's probably in that same process. I think to be healthy, some people have to get that distance, and sometimes it just has to be permanent. To me, having talked to a lot of people about this, it's just my observation is different personality types deal with this differently, and you have to do what's going to make you happy, what's going to bring you peace. And if Mormonism isn't it, it's not a good idea to spend the rest of your life trying to make that work if it's just not going to work. You know, life's too short. There's too many great things to do. So I have absolute respect for that. Many people in my life that I love and am around all the time, that's the decision they made, and they're great people. Great examples of people.
Thank you. Joanna, would you mind sharing when or at least that you also honor those decisions?
Oh, yeah. No, I just, my own experience was, you know, one where I was away for a while and I didn't know if I was coming back or not. And I find myself now back and that's bringing me joy, but I have no judgment and I have no basis to judge other people's paths. I just know that God loves their children and that, you know, life is long and we are here to gain experience. And I just have a sense of trust that there is a lot to be learned here. And I have no basis for judgment of others.
Right. And, you know, to me, part of it too is if you really look at Mormonism, what is it about? It's about growth of the soul. It's about transformation of character. And that's far more important than, you know, sacrament meeting attendance or a lot of other things. And so I think that certainly makes good sense. Brian, you're using the term health, you know, growth, all these different ways you can do it without outside of Mormonism. Jeff, I imagine you're perfectly comfortable with that idea, seeing how you're weighing it for yourself. Is there anything you want to sort of share as a broad framing about when is it, do you think, a breaking point might come, or what constitutes such a toxic experience within Mormonism where it might be healthier or something like that? Or
sure.
Are you recommending for everyone a sabbatical without radical separation, having to write that letter or something like that?
Oh, not at all. And in fact, I often say, as I'm describing my faith crises, and as I've framed this to friends and family who have wondered what happened, because I've just changed positions so drastically, that I believe God calls people to be Mormon every day. I believe that that path is one that God is employing in people's lives every single day.
Yeah, that's great.
However, mm-hmm. God loves all of his children, and if the Mormon church, for whatever reason, doesn't make a person feel loved. And I know that this happens. I've seen it happen. And if you're mm-hmm. gay or if you're black or a feminist or an intellectual or any number of other things, there may be a higher probability of the fact that you may not feel loved inside of the Mormon church. And when you're not loved and don't feel the love of God and don't feel closer to God, to me, it's a pretty easy decision for an individual to make that this is not right for them. So while I believe that God calls people into Mormonism every day, I also believe it is not for everyone. So.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay, well, I wanted to make that clear, and I'm that way too. I want to complicate that decision in some ways in the third section of the podcast. But I wanted to go next, you guys, to really let's do our best to argue what are the things that are going on that we should honor as important factors in the decision making that might lead somebody to say, I'm not healthy here, I'm not happy here, etc. So let's kind of argue the positive in terms of I want to separate myself, at least sabbatical, if not permanently, before we go in and maybe complicate and give reasons for staying. So does that make sense? So what do you see going on with people that their integrity is demanding that they leave? What are their concerns that deserve honoring? Brian, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I have met people who have experienced personal harm in the church in some way. Maybe they are an abuse victim, and part of that was framed, had some like a Mormon element to it, or was justified, or, you know, there's just different things can happen. And so much harm has been done that, that they both feel like they have to get out of this whole Mormon narrative to get free from constantly reliving that harm, and also possibly identifying with others who are harmed, you know, feeling like they're an accomplice to that if they stay in. And, you know, I've met some people with those kind of issues going on, and, you know, I got to really say there's something to be said about that. If that's what somebody's got to break free from, that's more important, I think, than perhaps being a member of a particular church. You know what I'm saying?
If
somebody's gone through that much trauma and their experience within Mormonism has been framed with this negativity, that's, I think, a very valid reason just to cut the ties, and you got to move on to something else that's positive. It just, you know, breaks my heart, but that happens to people.
Cool. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And we'll circle around, so keep any other ideas going. You'll have another chance. But Joanna, what do you see going on a lot of people who are making these choices? What's something we should bring to voice that you know is going on that's good and wonderful in their hearts?
And again, it's easiest for me. It feels most ethical to speak just from my own experience. So if it is just painful, overwhelmingly painful, whether that pain is from anger or from sadness or from depression, to attend church, don't. That was my experience. That was my choice. I sat there and said, does God want me to be feeling angry in this place where I'm supposed to be getting nourished? If anger is all I can bring right now, or sadness, and I was very sad, very, very sad, and my anger always comes out as sadness, and I looked at myself and I said, you know what, I don't think God wants me to do this to myself every Sunday. I just think that they're a bit more loving than that. I don't see what this is doing for anyone. So, I mean, if there are literally obstacles to purchase it, if there's something welling up inside of you that's literally an obstacle to your right participation, you need to pay attention to that and honor that and do what you need to take care of yourself. Sort of along the lines of what Brian said.
Jeff, what's going on in others' hearts or yours, or however you'd want to share that, man, what's really driving this when you start to lean in the direction of perhaps severing ties?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of reasons, but one that, and I think that both Brian and Joanna have touched on some really key points. The one I'll just add is that often guilt and shame come as the result of just the way Mormonism teaches, and part of that is because our leaders have a really difficult challenge, which is they want to point us to be better people. But they can't do like they once did, like in Brigham Young's time, where they would be very specific about the things you're supposed to do. So instead of doing that, they have to point to an ideal, because there are just so many more people and so many different circumstances and so many different cultures. But we spend a lot of time holding up an ideal and pointing to that and sort of demanding that we strive for it in perfection. And sometimes those ideals leave people out. And they can often just create guilt and shame in people that can be overwhelming and make them not like who they are, particularly if they fall short for whatever reason.
Cool. Thanks so much, Jeff, and all you guys on that. Let's do another round if you have one in you, or just, I don't know if all of you need to jump in, or you might not all have something to say, but does anyone else have any others that you know are behind the good intention of people that sometimes leads them to want to sever ties?
Sure, I'll add one more to what I just said, and that's my kids and my own decision play a very substantial role in the things that I consider, and both on the positive and the negative, the stay and go. There's definitely a case to be made on behalf of my kids in both camps, but that definitely gets considered, and I hear people all the time say, "Hey, I just can't go anymore because I don't want to expose my kids to that." So it's something that I certainly understand.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just to add on more, and these are things we mentioned before, we talked about the desire not to be a hypocrite, the desire not to pretend that you go along with something and then hold your tongue. That's one form of hypocrisy, some people would say, or to make claims just because that's the expected ritual way that you say things in the church or whatever. I know that desire not to be a hypocrite there. Some people just saying, you know, the prime factor in my life is truth, and I am seeing such a gap between claims and what I recognize as the true story that I can't do it. So all these things are good. I know that we've had a lot of technical difficulties, just to let you guys know here on this podcast, and we're running out of time, and I know, Joanna, we only are going to have you for about 15 more minutes. So if you don't mind, I want to move into this third section. Hopefully we've done a good enough job to say these are tough questions, these are tough issues. But Joanna, when you want to encourage a friend who you don't think is in such a toxic, harmful state, when you want to complicate that idea of exit, what is it that you usually point to as some sort of the cautions or the red flags or the things that you say, stop and pause a little bit longer?
Well, and I want to just express my gratitude for this conversation. I hope it provides a great deal of comfort. I mean, I'm so proud that our community is coming to a place where we can do this for one another, where we can support one another in these huge transitions that I believe are a part of any life of faith, whether it's in Mormonism or in another tradition altogether. And, you know, this is not something we were doing for each other even a few years ago, you know, like this kind of support and creating a space where we could articulate and within a Mormon space, you know, the actual faith crises that we have. And I don't end up, you know, I think one of the difficult things is that I don't end up having a lot of these conversations with people I go to church to. I certainly don't advertise myself at church as someone who is in a position to be counseling others. You know, the place where I do get questions is Ask Mormon Girl. And, you know, I've noticed, and I get a lot of questions, is there any place in the LDS church for me? And, you know, again, you know, I defer to the individual experience, but, you know, I would say that I do think that some of the battles of the last 20 years have led to just a reduced capacity in the culture because people have left. And I do think that, you know, whether it's from a position of less activity or sort of, you know, even participation in unofficial forums like this, you know, that there is capacity in our tradition for people to be loving and nurturing to one another in faith crisis, that the Orthodox story is not the only story. It's not the only space. And that it's worth at least remaining affiliated with the tradition because, you know, there is goodness in our tradition. There is beauty in it. It's worth holding on to. It's worth sacrificing for, even if it's not in the way we were taught to sacrifice. There's just a sense of belonging. I still feel a bond, a way that the Mormon story makes my just random little individual life feel so much more connected and a part of something, even if there is a great deal of damage the tradition carries within it. And even if there is damage that it continues to perpetuate, you know, this is the place I inherited, and I'm, you know, I'd like to do my best to leave it better than I found it, even if it's in a very unorthodox and unofficial way. And I'm just cheered and rewarded all the time by people who choose to keep casting their lots with this, you know, this crazy Mormonism and the ways that we are developing spaces we can love one another. So I think when people do choose to leave, I would never argue with that, but I do miss people. I miss people very badly. I'm glad to be back, and I hope others find a way back because I do think there's space in it for us if we claim it.
Cool. And seeing again you've opened the door for this, and I'm not sure how long before you have to drop off the call. Let me ask something now that I had prepared for later, and that is, you were hinting there at the end, and Brian, you were talking even a little bit with your military experience about, if I'd stayed, I maybe could have made a difference. And Joanna, you're kind of saying, I hope there, that at least was a piece of what you're saying there. So what is it, either you two or Jeff, how do you think about this idea when you hear it? And this is, again, out of order, I think, from where we might have normally taken it. But when you hear that, I stay because I want to make a difference. I can change better from within, et cetera. How do you negotiate the scales on that?
Well, see, I have no hope that I can change the institution.
Okay, so that's a good point.
But
on the other hand, you find the institution diminished when your friends leave.
No, not the institution.
Okay. Your own life.
The broader, the community, right? I mean, I'm in my head, I make pretty sharp distinctions. There is the LDS church, right? And then there's Mormonism. And those are two different things to me. I mean, not two different things. One is a subset of the other.
Good. And I actually am 100% with you. There wasn't a thought in my head after maybe the first couple months that I'm writing to the audience at the church headquarters. I knew that the ministry at Sunstone, if you want to call it that or whatever, it was simply about carving out a space in the community. And so I'm 100% with you. So I maybe asked that unskillfully, but there is sort of that idea of that some people will give weight to the idea of, if I go, there are people that I can't touch, or somehow or other this whole of the experience is diminished. And so I'm just wondering how any of you guys weigh that. And is it a reason for staying, or is it only sort of a frosting on the cake kind of reason?
So I can only offer how it affects me personally on this. But for me, it's not really weighed at all. And it's partly because I think that, disappointment can be measured as the difference between our expectations and reality. And if we set up expectations for ourselves that we can actually change the course of the entire church or the culture or whatever, I just think we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. So I don't believe that that's necessarily a good reason to stay, that you want to change the church. But if you feel fulfilled, if those that you care about feel fulfilled, if you have meaningful relationships there, there are lots of good things to consider. I sort of think of it like, when Impressionism came out as an artistic movement in the 1870s, actually Impressionism was defined by a French art critic who was actually demeaning it and basically saying, it's only impressions, it's not the real thing. And meanwhile, Monet was basically saying, this is the most beautiful way to represent the truth. This is the best way, the most vibrant way that I know of to represent what a sunset actually looks like or what flowers actually look like. And I think that you can look at Mormonism and say, that's not a real sunset. That's not what it claims to be. That's not what it really looks like. But it may be that there's something incredibly beautiful. And in fact, and this is in some ways where I am today, as I look at the alternatives, I may look around and say, this is the most beautiful reproduction of a sunset. Granted, it's not the actual sunset, but this may be the most beautiful reproduction of a sunset that man can create. And I have to recognize that beauty. And I think it's really tough to do that in a short period of time. And I think people often can be hasty and act out of emotion and anger.
Disappointment, yeah.
All that, yeah. I think the grass is always greener on the other side. It is a sort of philosophy or a reason that people often make very bad decisions, and that you have to slow down and really consider everything. And because an issue like this touches your own spirituality, your own identity, your own community, I would think it's impossible to do so with peace in a very rapid amount of time. So I just encourage people to go slow.
Good, and I bet we'll get some comments on that on the blog afterwards. Brian, I want to ask you how you weigh that stay in order to help out, raise the level, whatever it would be. And then Joanna, if you can kind of be thinking your final parting thoughts before you go. But and then the other guys and I will continue on a bit more. But Brian, on that issue of staying for reasons other than your own happiness, your own flourishing.
Yeah, I I have to agree with how Joanna put it. I don't have any particular agenda. I don't have any delusion that I'm going to change the institutional church. But I think, okay, here, I heard somebody say this. I can't remember where I picked this up. It was a long time ago. I heard somebody speaking once, and they were talking about groups that had profound influence on change. And one of the quirky, ironic characteristics of these groups in history that have made radical paradigm shifts are that one thing that they saw things beyond their own particular needs. Like, they would have a goal that might last beyond their own lifetime, so they weren't actually going to benefit from it directly. And the second thing was, they couldn't really have an attachment to a specific outcome, only that they expressed this great passion for whatever it was that was driving them. So it's kind of those two things, and those like groups that have that in them will make this great change. So like I said, I try not to have an attachment as to what specifically is going to change, but I just know that if I stay and I'm different than everybody else, I have this natural passion for this. I find a lot of things inspiring in Mormonism. I love being there. I love being a part of it. So indirectly, just by staying, I'm one tiny little widget in this giant machine. I can't deny that I have some effect, you know, what happens. And also, if I can find more people like me and I can get them to stay, collectively we have some kind of influence. I don't know where that goes.
No.
You know, but I can't
It makes it more survivable for us. I mean, you know, I mean, and here's the idea. Your religion should be a resource to you. You know, we've all been trained in Mormonism to take a huge, a huge amount of responsibility for entire institutions, for the entire world, right? We will bring the world his truth, the end.
Right.
But, you know, that's not the only way to experience religion. You know, religion should be a resource to us. And as we cycle through our lives, it should provide us community. You know, it should, you know, help us sanctify our time on earth. And maybe there'll be a heavenly reward, you know, maybe, you know, but yeah, the reason to stay and keep each other company is because it gives us joy, if it does.
Yeah, and I'm not even concerned about some heavenly reward anymore at this point.
Yeah.
I just know that I can make my buddy who lives on the other side of the neighborhood, his life maybe a little bit easier if I'm there to listen to him, or, you know, another friend somewhere else. I can at least affect somebody's life here and now. I can show up to that move and take some of the burden of that stress, you know, if I'm unloading the truck, or take a meal to somebody, or whatever it is. I don't know, you know. Who cares what happens after I die? At least I can make it a little bit better while I'm here.
Good, good. And yeah, I imagine we'll revisit this towards the very end a little bit. But Joanna, anything that you had on your list of things that I for sure wanted to talk about before you have to go?
Two brief things. And one is that I know that there are people who dialed in or tuned in, you know, really wanting, and for whom a lot of the sunnier sides of what we said is just not what you need to hear right now, because you're at a place where you're not seeing the beauty of it. It feels oppressive, overwhelming. It feels gross. It feels fraudulent. And I think everyone here has been through those moments, even though we're currently at a different place. So, you know, it's not like I don't acknowledge and honor the full range of feelings that any religion, especially one that's as intense as Mormonism, can bring out in people. It's just that, you know, emotions do change over time. So be patient, be attentive, take yourself seriously. I certainly don't take anyone's feelings unseriously. But just to try, I mean, maybe it's just a space I can go out on. If you want to think about integrity in terms of how I often hear it, not necessarily based on truth claims, but based on affiliating with an organization that sometimes I don't, you know, share similar social priorities with, for example, like, how can you belong to, you know, a church that's always been so anti-feminist? How can you belong to a church that is harmful, you know, that in some of its practices and commitments has sought to diminish the civil rights of gays and lesbians, and that creates what people have described as a very, very difficult, if not self-destructive, environment for gay and lesbian Mormons, you know, and I don't take any of those things lightly either. Nor do I have sort of grandiose visions that those things are going to change. I think, you know, having dwelt with the feminist contradictions of the church for a very long time, as long as I can just even have memory. I mean, I was a kid when ERA came out. You know, I think I've always acknowledged that inhabiting this tradition is full of contradictions for me, and that it's what one does with those contradictions that I think are inescapable in any dimension of life. It's what you do with them that is the measure of whether you lived a meaningful life and an honorable life, not trying to escape them entirely, because they will, you know, you will find them, they will follow you. Difficult, impossible commitments and loyalties that put you at odds with, that put you at odds within yourself. That's the measure of what it means to be a person of faith, you know. That's Kierkegaard's fear and trembling. That's what we're here to do. We're here to work it out. So, you know, I haven't seen, you know, there were times when I couldn't be in Mormonism because it was too painful to witness what my church that I really love was doing. But that for me hasn't been a reason to leave the tradition entirely and for good. And I don't have any judgment of those who do feel called that way. It's not my place to judge. And there are many very honorable people who have made those decisions. So I would just go out with that.
Thank you. Thank you. We're so glad when we get you, even when you have to leave early. So thank you so much,
pal. Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you all.
All right. Good night.
Joanna, it's been great. Really appreciate the conversation.
Good night, Jeff. Good night, Brian. Good night, listeners.
Bye, Joanna.
See ya. All right, guys. That's always a sad time when Joanna goes, but she brought some things up there that I think I wanted to jump into next. So let me just lead with the next foray. So in this whole idea of what she was talking about there, you know, every context of life is about this sort of negotiating what you've inherited with, you know, with ideals and all that stuff. And I guess I just wanted to bring up, to me, one of the key things that I will constantly, I don't know, not constantly, but when opportunities come up and I'll have a conversation with people, I'll just say, man, this is what it means to be a grown-up person. This is what it means to be a mature person, to realize all these things. And so the fact that you're having to do this in Mormonism really is just part of life and growth and whatnot. So does that resonate with either of you guys as a helpful thing when you think about your own journeys?
Yeah, for me, it absolutely does. I think I mentioned to you that I studied English at BYU, and there's a Walt Whitman poem that just two lines of it say, "You shall no longer feed on the specters of books, nor shall you look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself." And I do think that that's
wonderful.
I think that that's what growing up is. Is that, in fact, the line before that says, "You'll no longer take things at second or third hand." That you actually are just filtering them from yourself, and that's what growing up is. Sometimes I think it, you know, one could say that Mormonism doesn't always promote that, or that any religion doesn't promote that, because of course the center of gravity for religion is sort of stage three Fowler, but we all sort of have to grow beyond that. And part of the growth is actually sort of defying that gravity, if you will. So when we talk about, hey, we don't want our kids to have to go through this, sometimes I think what we're after is, I want my kids to skip stage 2, 3, 4, and 5 and just head straight to Fowler stage 6, which is just not possible. Growing and maturing is actually evolving through, you know, all 5 or 6 stages in sort of proper order and with proper experience.
Exactly. Yeah, the helicopter parent who wants to protect the child from harm is in many ways weakening that person. Yeah. Those types of things. Awesome. That was great. And I want that Walt Whitman poem to put on the blog. That's awesome. That totally nails what I think about when it comes to, you know, we talked about it even in the last few podcasts. We had Jennifer Finland at 5. We were talking about the maturation process of the human being, and there has to be differentiation from all the external sources of authority, and you have to become the authority within yourself. And then hopefully, as you do that, you'll realize that some of the harder edges that maybe you judged with at first you start to say, wow, there is some complexity here, and you begin to enjoy that process of looking at it from all sides. So, Brian, do you have anything you want to say about the spiritual maturity, or this is this life maturity thing, or do we want to go right into that whole question of often Mormonism puts us in this world of black and white, right or wrong, this or that, and so sometimes people will make the break and they'll say, because it isn't black or white, I'm leaving, but yet they're still in sort of a black and white world. So I'm going to give you the choice to either jump in on the first thing and then lead to the second one, or just go right into the second one.
I'll just the thoughts I have on that is I've thought a lot about how if I look back on my life and my experience and what I've, you know, how I've gotten to where I am, I couldn't get to where I am now, which I value a lot, without having gone through what I've gone through. You know, I mean, it's, there was no shortcut. If I could, you know, get into that DeLorean, you know, Back to the Future car and go back and talk to myself 20 years ago, you know, the fantasy of everybody, you know, that if you just sit around sometimes and think, if only I had known, you know, I don't, you know, if I imagine myself hopping in that car and going back in time and trying to have a conversation with myself, I don't think I would have, I don't know if I would understand me. You know what I'm saying?
Like, or I would have ignored me.
I would have ignored myself. You know,
right.
Like, you can't, there's something beautiful about human experience, both the pleasant and the painful side, but you can't explain some of these things. You can only experience your way through it, and whichever direction somebody ends up going, I have perhaps naively a faith in life that whatever direction you're going is really the direction that somebody needs to go. And it's not really my place to alter that, but if they're asking for help, or if they're asking for an opinion, or just a friend to listen to, you know, that you can get involved in. But, you know, it seems to me to come to a point of peace and resolution wherever you end up with this process of trying to figure out in your own integrity, like what you need, what that means to you. You have to incorporate the past into that in a way that leaves you with integrity, you know, that you've been consistent and learned something from this whole journey that you've been through.
That's awesome. And so just to jump off a little bit what you said, Brian, all the developmental theorists talk about, you know, it's important, and this ties in with what you were saying, Jeff, too. We need to kind of meet life in stages, and we don't want to skip any stage, because the way they'll talk about, for instance, as you're maturing through different parts of this, is just child development theory, or just, you know, human maturation, not necessarily Fowler and spiritual, but it relates to that as well. You want to go through each stage and complete all the tasks, because if you don't, you may move on intellectually, you may move on physically, but if, like, you've had some kind of process that didn't get covered, or some, you know, sort of abuse or something that happens at an early stage, even though you move on and you're thriving in others, you're always going to have this pathology. You're always going to have this point that is going to eventually say, I must be met. I have to have this broken part of me honored. Do you see what I'm saying there? And so I guess the idea is here is, if we skip, or we want to protect our children from that pulling apart process that we're going through, that is painful and stuff like that, somehow or other we may think that we can get them moved on to where they can become a fully integrated person, but in some ways I just think that eventually they're going to have to wrestle with it in some way, shape, or form. And so it's kind of nice to me to do it when there's a community of other people to do it with. You know what I mean? That you're taking it on at the right stage in life. And I would just love Mormonism to have that expectation a little bit more than it does. Like Jeff, you were saying, the center of gravity is at stage 3 Fowler, but for it to acknowledge that, guess what, guys, to be really grown up, you're going to be pulling a lot of this apart, but I promise you that there's, you know, peace on the other side. I would love to have that message be more prominent. So any of that make sense, or was it total ramble that we should cut?
No, that makes total sense. I'm really glad you said it. And I know that for me, the voices that have been on this podcast have been just that for me, a reminder throughout this process that there can be peace on the other side. And I've certainly spent a lot of time listening to the words of everybody on this podcast before this call to remind myself that there is a stage five, that the world isn't just stage three and stage four, which I think can be a difficult thing to sort of realize, whether you're in three or four.
You know, that's so true. I read Fowler. I think I shared in my thing with John. I read it my very first semester of grad school in religion, and it didn't mean a thing with me because I was so stage three. I thought that I'd, you know, prayed for myself. I'd proven it all. And therefore, none of those stages four or five, I felt like I was already at stage five when I hadn't even begun. You know what I mean? And then it's 10 years later. It's 1997, so I don't know if you guys know. I sat on the plane next to James Fowler. We were both heading to the American Academy of Religion in San Francisco. I saw that he was reading a book that was about religion. I go, hey, I bet we're going to the same conference. We just had this conversation where he introduced himself, and I go, James Fowler, that seems familiar to me. And he goes, well, and he was really humble about it. Whatever, you know, fame or acclaim I have often is tied to this book, Stages of Faith. And I go, oh, sure, I've read Stages of Faith, but what I didn't dare tell him is, like, it didn't mean a damn thing to me. You know, because I wasn't ready to hear it. I didn't know, like you were saying, Jeff, that there was something that was a far more integrated position than this pulling apart, proving it for myself that I thought I'd done in Mormonism. So the neat thing about it is he just was telling me that one of the things that was happening at the AAR that he was going to be part of is he was going to be part of a book signing and whatnot for his new book, which was called Faithful Change. So I read bought Faithful Change. I missed the time that he was signing. I kept carrying it around with me, hoping I'd bump into him at the conference again to sign it for me. But I read it on the plane on the way home, and it was just like, as he, you know, that book was more about shame and guilt and processing those kinds of things, but yet he did the stages, and it was like, oh my heck, I can't even, this guy has totally described my entire journey. And like you say, Jeff, I had no clue ahead of time that it was really there. And so I think in some ways, until you're really in the crisis or even beginning to see it on the outside, that you really believe that it's a reality.
Yeah. That's a really, really good point. And I'll just add that I think that especially in the early stages of phase four, because we often talk, in fact, you're the one who's made it fluent in my sort of repertoire of thought that we don't know who discovered the properties of water, but we know it wasn't the fish, is often something we use to characterize stage three. But early stage four is much the same, where you tend to think in a very sort of binary way, but instead of the sort of positive way you viewed the world in phase three, it's sort of countered with negativity. And to just remember that the world is much bigger and much more complex and much more colorful and beautiful than either of those two things can contain is, I think, an important to point out that stage four can create the same sort of false dichotomy that stage three did.
Yeah, and Fowler, just to let readers know, if you do read it, he'll talk about stage four almost having two phases to it. There is that pulling apart, and then there's that beginning of acknowledging even complexity within this demythologizing mode that then sort of can prepare you sometimes for moving on if you choose to go with that. But so trading one black and white to another one is a caution that I just wanted to put in there, and I just think it's so important. Let me just share.
Can I pull this really back?
Yeah, please. Yeah,
I got a brief point about this very important issue of, like, protecting children from, you know, having to go through this, which awesome. I hear a lot, and I think it's there's a lot of valid concerns, but something that occurs to me is if we're constantly trying to keep our children from hearing anything that might upset them or that might cause them to think too hard about stuff. This process of pulling away and becoming your own center of authority, you can protect your kids from all those outside influences, from having a bad experience at church or a bad experience at school or a bad experience with friends. But what will happen is eventually you as the parent are going to be the one that they're going to have to pull away from. So it's like you still can't, by protecting them from all this stuff, you can't avoid this process, because eventually if you do that so completely, you're going to be the one that they're going to have to pull away from to become their own authority, which is what they need to do. I'm no expert on child development, but I don't know.
No, that's
I have a couple of adult kids.
Yeah, differentiation
that's
is
a great point.
Important. All right, guys, it's kind of hard for me to judge how long we've been going because we've had so many stops and starts in this one, but I would like to, let's say, wrap up in the next 20 minutes or so.
Yeah.
So if that seems like a target for you guys, let's go with it. What are other reminders or cautions? And Jeff, thank you so much for saying that Brian and Joanna and I and the conversations that you're seeing have been part of that process. That's neat. So thank you for sharing that.
You bet, and it's true.
Okay. What are some other just like little cautions? It doesn't have to be more than just a minute or two on these, but let me throw one out there. For instance, there's the great Kirsten Stendahl, say that the way you want to engage two different things is, and has different things, but the third one is never compare the best of one with the worst of another. You know what I mean? So if you're leaving something, our tendency is to focus on the negative things and then to look at what's ahead, and you only see, like you said, I think, Jeff, the greener pasture.
Yep.
And so we have to, so at least one of the cautions that I would throw out there is just, make sure that we're really with integrity doing it, because I shared this, I think, in my interview with John, as much as I've deconstructed the Book of Mormon, and I pretty much am not in the camp that it's likely historical, but so even if I come to that thing, my integrity demands that I honor the role that it played in my life of basically being the catalyst for giving myself hope to pull myself out of the drugs and the club scene and all the things that I was doing that were not for me. And so, my integrity can't say that just because one piece of it went, I can't forget about all the good things. And so I think that's partly the reason that Joanna was saying it was so good for her to have a sabbatical, and for Jeff, you to say you're taking your time, is because I think in that closeness of the emotion, it is so much easier to see the things that are causing us the wounds at that moment. And so sometimes we need to step away for that longer view and say what was good there too.
I think that's really a key point.
As well as to spend more time in the other thing and say, is this really quite as green as I imagined it to be? So both things are there. So what else do you guys put out there as cautions, or at least if we were to argue, so we've kind of said these are the reasons that are positive for people might wanting to leave, but what else do you put out there as sort of like slow down?
So I would add that remember what your ultimate goal is. And in my case, and in fact, this was really well defined by Carolyn Pearson at the Mormon Stories Salt Lake conference, when she said something to the effect of everyone should come to peace with the religion that they were raised in.
Yeah, she read a piece from her book, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
Somewhere in her Circling the Wagons,
Or something that really captured that well. And then she spoke to it. But for me, that's become the aim. And when that is your goal, it's really tough to make a decision out of anger. I mean, you're not going to find peace inside of anger. So you have to be willing to work through that. And I think as you're working through that, you want to create as many options for yourself as you possibly can. And then just related to that, and it also comes from peace, is that we just can't forget that so many of the greatest joys, if not all the greatest joys in our lives, come from the interactions that we have with friends and family. And it's really hard, at least in my case specifically, to find really meaningful friend and family relationships that haven't been touched by Mormonism. So many of my relationships have been fostered inside of Mormonism, and particularly my family relationships on both sides of my family just touch Mormonism in such a real and profound way that, one, I have to honor that. And two, as I'm going through this process, I have to be respectful of their beliefs and remember that I once believed very much the way that they believe today. And at times, integrity means that I put the value on my relationships higher than the value on what happened 175 years ago in upstate New York. Because with a little bit of time and distance, I would say that those questions mean far less to me today than they did 12 months ago when I began a faith crisis.
Very good. Thank you. Brian, you want to throw something out there or react to Jeff?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to something that Jeff said made me think about this, and it's about how important our and rich life is because of our relationships with people, and like you guys, you know, I got family, I have friends, a lot of, you know, up to this point in my life, like Jeff said, a lot of things have been touched by Mormonism, and I think there's, you know, one argument about moving slow is you a lot of times can't unsay things. And
great point.
Yeah.
I know how I have felt this, you know, where you want to just jump up and be validated and say, I know all about this and that and you know, all this controversy and none of you know, how bad it is. You know, anyways, I have felt that.
Yes.
But you can't like I said, you can't unsay these things to people sometimes. And you have these relationships and you can damage these relationships. These people have been, like Jeff said, in a place where we were once upon a time. So we should know how that is. And actually, while I was looking into, you know, thinking ideas about this podcast, I came across this really odd article in a medical journal, and it was about... it was about Japanese oncologists, cancer doctors. And in Japan and also in Korea, there's this really fascinating thing that if a patient has cancer, and this was like in a medical journal, they found that only 1 in 5 patients were even told that they had cancer.
Huh?
Right, I know. The gears are turning in your head and you go,
right?
What? So what happens is they go into the doctor because they're sick. And the doctor will do all the tests, but they won't tell them that they have cancer because they don't want to trouble them. What they will do is tell their family. The doctor and the family will get together and decide on the treatment. And this person, like, they won't tell the person because it's going to be troubling and confusing. And they find the person gets angry and it just doesn't really do a whole lot of benefit. And I thought that's just such a radically different cultural perspective of this sort of group mentality where the family knows best and the group knows best for an individual. And sometimes an individual can't think clear. And I'm actually getting to a point of it. And I thought to myself, there's a really odd parallel with that within Mormonism where we're such a strong group community. You don't want to walk into Elder's Quorum and say, you all are dying of cancer, which is
awesome. No,
and I'm joking about this, but isn't it something similar when if you walked into Elder's Quorum and said, the Book of Mormon is not true, Joseph Smith made it all up and I can prove it, and here's, you know, you start writing on the blackboard, you might as well tell all these people that they're got 6 months to live because it will feel the same way to them. So that's not... it's a really weird analogy, I know, but I saw these kind of connections here.
Yeah.
And just out of respect for not causing trouble for people, they don't want this trouble. Maybe their life is happy the way it is. And I wasn't happy that way, and I got ejected from that mindset just because that's the way I'm wired or that's the way God made me. I can't help it. But I don't need to cause that trouble for them.
Exactly. Because
what it really does is damage my relationships. Like my parents. I love my parents. They're wonderful people. They gave me a great example of Mormonism. This is just one of those subjects we can't talk about. Their whole life has been invested in this. And while I find it entertaining to like pick apart these ideas, and it makes me feel good about myself, and actually I still like going to church, it makes them very upset.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you just made, Brian, which is sometimes in that moment, you'll want to do it because it's going to validate yourself. And you may justify it by saying you're about to help them. But if you really are truthful with yourself, you'll see that you're actually doing it for yourself and not to to help them and inform them of their cancer.
Yeah, it feels noble that you're going to free them from their ignorance. But like you said, it's really, you know, if you think about it, there might be a part of that where you want validation. And we all want that, you know. We want to feel like what we're doing, you know, that we're not crazy, we're not dumb, and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it hit me, too, that one of the ways we could phrase it, too, is, you know, they've allowed us our journey. We need to allow them theirs. And hopefully we weren't one of those people that were just victimized by somebody coming in and saying, I am going to thrust you into this new world against your will. So let's say that we'll say that 99% of people hopefully come to these questions naturally. The course of life suggests it. And I think that's by far the better way. Just they were kind enough to let you come to these questions on your own, and maybe they will do it on their own as well. And then when you look at your parents, Brian, I look at my in-laws who, again, they don't know what to make of me with these questions. But on the other hand, you know, as much as I've maybe deconstructed things, the goodness of their life, you know, is far balanced out to the adventurousness of my ideas. You know, so I was like, which is more important? Who's to say? But like I say, it's our temperament that we're called to these questions, and it's not everybody's, and we shouldn't do it. But you know, your example here also took me into a new area, and this reaches back to something I said earlier, Jeff, that we'd want to talk about, and that is leaders and the predicament that church leaders are in to teach ideals and to know that there's certainly outliers. There's people for whom this message isn't going to serve them the best way possible, you know. But they're sort of in that predicament of preaching to the center, of suggesting, you know, it's like the 99 versus going after the one. Even though that ideal is there for the one, for the most part, they're concerned with the people for whom Mormonism is all-encompassing, for whom it works, for whom this is the sense of what the universe and its purposes are. These are the values that I want to convey to my children. They're concerned with that. And then I think we also need to realize that they're concerned with what happens on Sundays. These meetings are not college classes. They're hopefully worship services. They're hopefully encouragement services. They're hopefully those things that we hear often in testimonies. I come to church and I get my spiritual rejuvenation for the week. Church leaders have to kind of be thinking about, and yet it leaves people like us saying, boy, I sure wish they were serving our needs on Sunday. I wish we'd really dive into which one of these letters were actually written by Paul and which weren't, you know?
Right.
So do you want to riff on that, any of you guys, if you, you know, this idea of maybe one of the reasons to complicate your decision to leave would be, if I were the leaders, what would I be doing? You know, that's, at least that helps me sometimes.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really important thing to consider. And I mean, I've thought a lot about the parable of the lost sheep, and I think I've concluded that what Christ was pointing us towards was an ideal for us as individuals, not an institutional mandate. So I absolutely believe the institution is focused on the 99, and can't possibly serve the one, whether you're talking about, you know, Sunday school curriculum, or whether you're talking about, you know, the Pauline epistles, you have to be focused on the base, if you will. So I do think that that's a really important thing to consider.
Yeah, and I my whole thing is, I understand what you're doing, just don't make it extra hard for me to be me within the church. You know, you don't need to add those little extra layers that show me exactly how far outside I am. I just would love them to occasionally, well, first of all, just don't do the negative hardline messages, the all or nothing stuff. But on the other hand, you know, it would be nice to have a bone or two thrown my way to say, you know, doubt is a part of faith. You know, that at least the people who doubt aren't sinners. You know, I'd love that bone every once in a while, but at least baseline, don't make it harder for me to be me.
Yeah. I don't need any extra cinder blocks in my backpack.
That's right. Brian, any thoughts on, you know, if you were in the church leadership position, does that help you, or is there, you know, an angle you want to take off on that?
Gosh, I purposely try to stay out of the limelight, so if I was the, I don't know, I have to agree, if I was all of a sudden, you know, switched bodies with Thomas S. Monson and I was in charge of the whole thing, I don't know if I mean, I guess I'd be tempted to change things slowly, but
right.
I don't think you can just jump out. Well, no, I don't even think it's my position to tell anybody where they need to be going. So I guess I'm just never destined for a leadership position like that.
Yeah. Well, but it is a mindset that I sit and look, say, okay, I'm feeling like the institution isn't meeting my needs. Well, what would I do if I were in there? And, you know, and then I'm like Joanna says, it's so cool that we have these forums now.
Yeah. I don't have any complaints. So I guess, I don't know. If I hear a general conference talk, and, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. The one where, you know, if you have doubts or it's either all or nothing or it's either Satan or God. That doesn't speak to me, but I'm okay with that. You know, it's just like, well, sorry, I think you're wrong. And I know that's shocking to, you know, some people at church, but I'm just really comfortable. I guess I've just gotten to a point in my life where I've realized that, and maybe this is arrogance, that sometimes those guys don't know any more than I do, and that's okay, because I'm a knucklehead too, and maybe that's the wrong attitude, but I don't know. It's what makes it work for me.
I don't think that that's the wrong attitude. In fact, I'm only pointing this out because I think it's the only way to make it work after you've eaten of the fruit of knowledge of good and evil. Is that once you've been where we've all been, that's the only way to be functional, right? That's it, only when you look at the leaders and say, hey, like they're making mistakes. And one, I have to identify that as a mistake. And two, I have to acknowledge that I would make mistakes too and be okay with that. Only when you're at that place can you ever participate fully, because if you continue to expect something more from them, I think you'll just be set up for disappointment.
Yeah, that's the big thing, awesome. The gap between the expectations and reality.
You got it, for sure. On the institutional level, I have been helped tremendously in my own life by Bonner Ritchie. Do you guys know who he is and sort of his stuff on the institution versus the individual?
Yeah.
Yeah. He just really lays out there. He's an organizational behavior professor and a Middle East peacemaker and whatnot. But he basically says every institution, and the church is an institution, believe me, it's an institution. He says it always is concerned with its own preservation, its own forward movement. It has to protect. It has to have people that are willing to help keep the, you know, lights on and the business flowing. So it's going to have its own thing. And he says the individual is always going to be at risk of being depersonalized or sort of, you know, there's always that tension between your needs and the institutional needs. And he says you just can't escape that. But he says there's a great line. He says, while I do not feel that we can make organizations safe for people, I think that we can help people protect themselves from organizational abuse. And so this sort of threw this way, and I'll go ahead and make sure I link to this one on the podcast. He really has some great ideas for us to just be aware of these things, and sort of this awareness that these dynamics are going around us, I think, could really help. I know it has helped me, you know, make peace sometimes.
Yeah, I've read that article. It was a good one.
Cool. I've got another one of these things that sort of helps me say it's time for caution. Do you guys mind if I throw one out right now?
Yeah, go
for it. And that is, William James, one of my favorite philosophers, probably my favorite philosopher, he's an empiricist. He says that, you know, for him, he wants all of his thinking stuff to be grounded in his own experience or the facts of the universe. And then he talks about how a lot of philosophers don't like empiricists because they want it clean. You know, they want the, you know, right, the Platonic ideal, and empiricism is messy and stuff like that, because, and then here's the term that I love, it has wild facts. There are wild facts in the universe that just don't fit cleanly within any theory. And so this whole idea of wanting to be based in reality, and I think that that's what so many of us who've dove into church history, or we've deconstructed scripture, or we recognize, you know, the human frailties that are all around us. We're those empiricists dealing with the wild facts of the universe, and we're in an institution that wants to present it clean, you know, the mythic story, the pioneer faith, the all these different things that are, you know, pointed to this clean arc of, you know, the gospel marching forward, etc., through the universe. That's sort of like that tension between the philosopher and the empiricist. You see does that make any sense so far?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I just like that, and then I'm going to pair that with my other favorite philosopher, and this is just the coolest metaphor for me. It's Alfred North Whitehead. He's the guy who's considered the person who is the grounding for process theology. So some of you may have heard of that. But Alfred North Whitehead says, "The path of true learning is like the flight of an airplane. It begins on the ground of observation, you know, the ground of empiricism. But then it takes off in the air," and he talks about it being, I think his whole term there is speculative imagination or something like that. In other words, you get up in the rarefied air where you're taking the 10,000, you know, foot view, and that's sort of that theoretical level. But then you land again, but your ground has now changed because you've done that dance up in the theory level, you know what I mean? In other words, you're now seeing things and ideas are clearer and fresher to you because you've taken that flight in imaginative speculation. So, you know, you're on the ground. This is the hard realities. I go up in the mythic level. I go up in the level of where I'm just weighing all the possibilities, but then I come back to the ground, and that ground now looks new because of the other thing. But then guess what? You have to do it again and again and again. That life is, that's the way you advance in life, is to visit and revisit and revisit and revisit these questions, always wanting to make sure you've taken into account the wild facts, the things that don't fit your theory, but then jump up in the air and think about it. You know, whether that's what we're arguing here for perhaps a sabbatical is that time in the air or something. When you land again, you're always going to see things fresh once more. So I don't know if that, for me, that's just like, if that's a path of true discovery in science and in philosophy and all that stuff, it works for me with Mormonism too. I just can't tell you how many times I'll revisit and revisit and revisit, and every time it's a reward.
Yeah, I think quite a few people that they're dealing with this integrity issue and they feel like they're not getting something. They're not being fed the right way within Mormonism. I've seen a bunch of people go off to check out Buddhism or yoga or whatever it is, you know, evangelical Christianity. And then, and maybe this is kind of playing on what you just said, you know, maybe instead of not just like vertical up in the air, but more horizontal, like checking out what's on the other side of the fence
there. Yeah.
And then jumping back over. But I mean, I can think of some, you know, several people online that, you know, I've come to become friends with and had conversations with that do this sort of thing, like they go out to some other tradition and it's finally like, oh yeah, this is what I needed, but they kind of bring that back in with them, you know, and can still in some ways be connected to Mormonism, either active or, you know, not active, but still they're still connected to it in some way, but they've found this feeding source that they're that one of these one lost sheep, but they, you know, went out and found their own pasture. So anyways, I've seen some people deal with it that way, you know, that the constant frustration of not being fed the right way, you know, for what's going to make them grow, and then finding that somewhere else and bringing that in.
Yeah, and seeing new things and taming some of those wild facts because you now have something to compare it about or compare it with or something. So,
Jeff, you need a couple other tools in your toolbox or something.
Awesome. Jeff, do you have any more of your, like, what's keeping you in the question still versus making a hard decision at this point? What else are things are you weighing?
The one that I think I've mentioned but is worth mentioning again, or at least in more detail, is is the thing that sometimes makes it hard to stay is how much of the content at church is focused on the truth claims. And the specific truth claims I'm referring to are historicity of Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith as a prophet, First Vision, and restoration of priesthood, and the church having the only claims on priesthood keys. The amount of time that is spent on that is really substantial. And so for me, that's the only question, for instance, when I'm considering my kids. It's, I would love them to have all other aspects of Mormonism, and I could deal with all other aspects of Mormonism, maybe some shame and guilt and some of the way we teach sexuality and a few other things
like
that.
Right, right. We could do better, for sure.
Revise. But I can deal with all that, but just how much of the content is focused on that. And I think, at least for me, that's definitely an open question. Can you experience the richness of Mormonism without believing literally, or even once believing literally, recognizing that my kids will probably never go through the period that I've gone through, which is believing literally, given, you know, where I sit today? Can they still experience all the great things that I've experienced? Because I'd love for them to go, you know, I consider my mission a phenomenal experience in my life. But if I had not believed it literally, it could have never been what it is, what it was. So that's an open question for me.
Now, right there, that was an interesting move. You loved your experience because you believe literally, but you're saying you don't think you're going to let your kids have a literal belief that might lead them to a similar great experience of going on a mission? Is that?
It's not the let them. It's that I don't know that I can foster that. I don't know that I can. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of work to come to the conclusion that it's all true, right? I mean,
right,
it took
right.
a tremendous amount of work. I don't know of anybody who just sort of came into it easily and then was able to go on a mission with lots of conviction and you know, have a really successful mission, because it comes painfully, or not painfully, but with struggle, and because it comes often with the help and guidance of people that care about you. And because it would be very difficult for me to do that, I don't know that I can create the same experience for my kids, and therefore is it one that they can experience at its best? Or
interesting.
Yeah.
Very good. You know, what you said there reminded me of something else that was in the edges of my mind that maybe I'll just bring up here. And that was the emphasis on truth claims that you're saying is what's going on at Mormonism. That's probably the hardest thing for you, is that everything is emphasizing it's true, it's true, it's true. You know, these are exactly the words of God, or, you know, he really did break through in a unique way to tell Joseph Smith and the current prophets this, that, and the other thing. So you have that thing. And yet, you know, religion theory, or at least those who've studied religion, and they talk about what it really is all about, at least at its origins, it's usually a founder who says, I've had this experience, and I invite you to have this experience too. You know, it's like, and here are the things that I did to get this experience, and so that's where sort of practices and things come in, and they say, you know, this will help put you in a position where you can know what I know. So as I look at Mormonism, that's exactly what I think was going on at the beginning. Joseph Smith says, I wish that every one of you could be prophets. You know, this is it. These are my experiences with God. And you look at section 93, it says right there, you know, that's the goal. Or, you know, we have the whole idea of calling an election made sure, is to have these experiences firsthand for ourselves. And so if we can keep that in mind, that sort of says every truth claim in Mormonism is, it's somehow, anything that could be captured with your words, anything that could be thought with thoughts versus, you know, the experience of it all, the embodiment sort of element of it, if you can think it, if you can write it, right there, religion from its very things. And I know there's tons of scriptures that point us there. They'll point us beyond the literal. They point us beyond what can be phrased in words. You know, eyes cannot see, ears cannot say. You know, Jesus praying, it's impossible to capture that experience of that, but yet we're all invited to do it ourselves. So somehow or other, for me, it's like I'm able to sit there and say, when people say, this is exactly, you know, the formulation of words that captures the essence of the universe, I'm like, no way, because guess what? I've dove in and I kind of had an experience, and I see that what you're saying points to what I'm after, what I've experienced, but it doesn't capture it.
Yeah.
Okay, so sorry. Yeah. I'm just like going on and on tonight. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense whatsoever, but
that's great. Appreciate it.
Especially just adding to what you're saying, I think the whole Kirtland prototype endowment experience, you know, the fasting for days in the temple and the singing, and, you know, it was before they formalized later on the endowment kind of that we more think of today. I think you're right. Like, there's a lot of things that indicate that Joseph wanted everybody to see God and Jesus. He wanted everybody to, you know, become prophets and all this stuff. And I'm diving into that point because I think that a lot of the value of religion is lost if you don't let yourself jump into the story and let yourself run with it a little bit. Even if you know you can jump back out, you know, a religion that doesn't even say that it's right. Like, what kind of religion is that? You know, like, well, we're not actually right, but why don't you show up at that building, you know, on Sunday? You can hear
money.
A bunch of stuff that's probably pretty mediocre. You know, but I don't know. This is just from my perspective at this point. I see religion as sort of like the art of philosophy, or of living a life, or a human experience, or something like that. And yeah, you got to dive into the story. That's the magic of it, you know. And Mormonism's got some really great rides in the amusement park. You know, if you don't, you can sit there on the ground and look at the roller coaster and talk about how thrilling that must be, and, you know, pick it apart intellectually. But if you don't actually buy the ticket and get on the roller coaster and go down that giant hill with your arms up in the air and you're screaming and, you know, scare yourself silly, then you're kind of missing some of it.
Awesome. Jeff, I want you to jump in. Let me just, two things that occurred to me, and it kind of relates to what you're talking about, Brian. We did a podcast here on Mormon Matters on ritual, and sort of the emphasis there was, it's not the ritual itself, it's just the chance that it gives you to sort of separate yourself from normal space and time and enter into, you know, a different realm where it's more likely that you know, you're going to experience things at an archetypal level. You're going to sort of feel truth rather than think truth. You know, you're getting out of your head, you're getting out of your way, your spirit's able to commune. And so the act of rituals is not about, oh, what am I doing? Do I stand up here, or do I sit down here? Do I hold my arm this way? You know, that's one level of seeing ritual, but really the ritual's inviting you into sacred space and time. And that's just sort of how I've also come to read scripture these days. I recognize human hands. I recognize personality quirks. And I know the history of how some of these books got into the canon, and, you know, all that different stuff. But I just read scripture now as a way to take me out of normal time and space, and, you know, enter into this realm of, I don't know, the eternal or whatever you'd want to call it. And just, I'm just glad for it being a vehicle now, not that it's literally true, but it's a conduit to this space where transformation might happen a little bit more with me. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's kind of at least a tie-in to what I was saying before, that, you know, have the experience versus worrying about the actual words or the claims.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. To me, that's what's left, right? I mean, that's and to be honest,
but not left as in that's left as a leftover.
No,
that's what's left after the real experience. That's the treat.
That's right. That's what really matters, right? When you reduce it down to its very essence, it's those truths that you learn through the ritual. So how the ritual came to be, what are the mechanics of the ritual? That was never the powerful part, whether you were believing literally or not anyway. For me, it's how can I get the fullness of that ritual without the beliefs that I once had, recognizing that there's still archetypal value, but can I still get the fullness? Because it was once incredibly powerful when I believed in it at every level, but I still certainly value it, and particularly scripture for its sort of metaphor and life lessons and truths, regardless of whether there was an ark or Jonah lived inside an actual whale.
Which he didn't. No, let's just get that one clear. but you know, just right there, it's so much more powerful metaphorically than it is.
Yes.
So I was like, you're missing out. And you know, it's so interesting too that the Jews recognize Job as going with the wisdom literature, not, you know, it's not the Torah, you know, the five books of Moses, but it's with Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, it's considered that, and yet we want to take it so literally, you know, it's such a much more powerful story, you know, especially when it's impossible to believe God and the devil were having a bargain over whether this, you know, the stuff that frames Job in the Bible. So anyway, Job and Jonah are my favorite ones to just kind of say, you guys are missing the boat if you really think that this stuff is literal. So anyway, sorry about that. But all right, guys, it's time to end, but I want you to please, what's left on your sheet that's your best stuff that you didn't get to say so far?
So Dan, I have one question for you that I wanted to make sure that we address, and we sort of touched on, or you mentioned it before, but we never really got a chance to have much discussion about it.
Please.
So as I mentioned, every person on this podcast has meant a lot to me in terms of the icon and what they represent in sort of navigating the faith crises. And I've certainly listened to your podcast with John, where he was throwing things at you. And you'd mentioned, and you guys talked a little bit about the temple recommend questions. And I think the phrase you used before was mental gymnastics. And
right.
And to sort of lay out where I am on that, I definitely don't feel comfortable getting a temple recommend because of four main questions inside the temple recommend. You know, the prophet, seer, and revelator, and only person who possesses the keys, the full tithe payer. And that's just because I'm not comfortable paying to the church when their mission is to proclaim the gospel, and they're not willing to be transparent, and just different values, and you know, and then the role of Christ and Savior, and then perhaps most importantly, do you have a testimony of the restoration of the gospel in these latter days? So I bring that up to just ask you if you can articulate for us on those four specific points how you or how anyone sort of knows what we all know, sort of post-faith crisis, can answer those with integrity. So what actually is going on inside of you to answer those specifically, how you can sort of make that all work? And I hope it's not sounding like I'm challenging your...
Well, and I'm hoping Brian will want... I hope this is a question to Brian, too. So
oh, you're going to drag...
Well, especially if I don't give you a satisfactory answer, Jeff, because I'll let you know that I just don't worry. I don't worry about the specific questions. I've just come to see the choice to participate with the temple or not as can be completely completely up to me and God. And if the church thinks that those questions are the true gatekeepers of worthiness, they're wrong. You know, it's the intent of my heart. It's the goals I have. It's my reasons for wanting to separate from, you know, everyday cares, you know, dive into an archetypal story like you guys were saying, or Brian was saying about, you know, I'll jump into Adam and Eve again, or I'll jump into, you know, those kinds of archetypal levels. And so I know it's going to feel like a cop out to you, but is it just 15 years of living into this perspective that I have, where I sort of trust myself and my own relationship with God to not even worry about pleasing this ecclesiastical leader who's in the full integrity of his heart is doing his best job? But on the other hand, I don't think he really cares what I think. I think he just wants me to say, you know, I'm on a path that says I'm worthy to celebrate in the ritual life of my community in this way. You know, that to me is like, you know, the meta question there. And, you know, I'm on record for what is it? I've deacons three or four of those questions. I can't remember all the ones that you just asked. I know I've done a podcast where I've shared my views of the atonement that are unorthodox, and I've shared my views on, you know, certain aspects of Joseph Smith. But for me, it just... You tell me, is it a cop-out to say I don't worry about the specifics, or am I allowed just to say somewhere along in my life I lived into a comfort zone that if I'm going to hell because I'm answering out of integrity, then I would be really shocked because that kind of God would be a jerk, you know?
Yeah.
So if you want me to go, you know, more specific, I can, but honestly, that's how it has happened to me. I've just lived into, you know, a comfort zone with my own, you know, heart. That seems with me on the line, because I'm not going to go out and, you know, share temple secrets or whatever it is they're trying to protect, you know, people from taking on covenants. In other words, I can look at the covenants that I make in the temple and feel quite comfortable within all those. You know, so that's what matters rather than the gatekeeper issues.
So I think that if I were to say back to you, I just want to make sure that I understand you correctly. The individual questions don't matter to you because they're a means to an end, which is them sort of making sure that you're comfortable being there and that you're sort of in check with the ultimate goal, which is to go and make and keep covenants. And you're fine because you know what those are, and you're fine making those decisions, but the individual questions are not where you're getting hung up.
Yeah, and I'd pick, you know, 10 different questions if I were writing them, because I would always want to focus on, I would want to focus truly on the, are you, you know, living,
are you kind to the people in your life?
Yeah, we had the lesson in Sunday school.
Are you
yesterday.
A good example
about,
of the, you know, yeah. the charity of the
pure,
Savior?
Living pure religion, yeah. Are you concerned for the widow and the orphan and visiting in prison? Those would be my questions rather than sort of a mental assent to beliefs that I've already kind of just 10 minutes ago kind of said, you know, any claim on that level that you can put it in your brain and say it with words, you know, at best, those types of things are pointing towards having an experience of those things rather than being able to say them well, you know, articulate them in a talk. You know, I'd rather just convey through spirit, you know, that I've been touched by this and it's an attractive thing, you know, I don't know. So, yeah, but you did good. You did good on taking my 5-minute ramble and putting it into 1 minute there, Jeff. But are you satisfied? Or is it like I really, because if you're asking me to do the mental gymnastics, I don't think I can give you satisfying answers because I'm just not playing that game. But on the other hand, I will attempt it if you want me to.
So I would love to just push you a little bit, because when they say, or when your bishop says, do you have, or do you believe that Thomas S. Monson is the only one that is authorized to exercise all priesthood keys?
Hey, Dan.
Yes, please.
Yeah, go ahead. How about, just for an interesting twist, I'll jump in, because...
Okay, please.
As strange as this is...
Thank you!
I haven't bothered with a temple recommend in probably 8 years or more. But it's not because I feel like unworthy or that's not a place I should be. I just think I'm so far outside of things. The one aspect is I feel I'm just so far outside of things that I don't want to make other people feel uncomfortable there. And the second issue is not
mean,
having a temple
mean by, recommend. By them knowing that you're there along with them and they know enough about you that they would wonder? Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, that it would make them uncomfortable.
Interesting.
And the second thing is, and this is a mental calculation I do with this whole relationship with the church, if I don't have a temple recommend, I can get away with more nonsense. I'm laughing about that.
Oh, well, I mean, it doesn't give him a tool to pull you back in line with?
It's one less thing that they can hold over my head. Anyways, I could go. I don't want to go into all my reasons, but... like I said, I'm totally A-okay with the big man upstairs. I would feel totally comfortable there myself. But anyways, so I'm going to jump in with that twist because I think we have really different approaches. And I actually don't have issues with most of the faith questions. So that's why I was going to be willing to jump in with that.
So how would you answer that question? And I'm asking on behalf of people that would say, how can you not believe in the major truth claims and still go to the temple, especially given that Mormonism spends so much time pointing to the temple, and that if I want to experience it all after having been through a faith crisis, is that possible? Is a question that I guarantee is on many of the minds of our listeners. So how do you navigate those specific questions? So when somebody says, are you authorized to exercise all the priesthood keys? What I'm hearing Dan say is that that's not the right question. So I'll play along to satisfy you, but I'm right with God and I'm fine going through this ritual with you in order to get to the temple so that I can feel at one with God. And I feel like I'm doing this with God along the way anyway. So I'm totally cool with what I'm doing, but
I'm fine with that too. But
how do you navigate that specific question? Because what happens in my mind when I get to that question is, no, I do not believe that. Or do you have a testimony of the restoration of the gospel in these latter days? I know that what he's asking is related to Peter, James, and John, and John the Baptist, near the Susquehanna. And I'm not sure that I can't say that I believe that happened. So is there a way that you can just help me understand that these either aren't the right questions or there's something bigger than that?
I know a lot. You have to kind of. I think you have to kind of address these questions. I mean, I accept the way Dan says it. I'm totally cool with that too. But a lot of people are going to focus on those questions, whether those are the valid questions or not. Let's just say we already had that conversation. So addressing those specific questions, a question like, does Thomas S. Monson have all the priesthood keys and he's the only person that can exercise them? I think when these questions start to be, and this is going to be my perspective, I think when those questions start to get asked, we start attaching loads and loads and loads of baggage to those questions. And in my mind, they're very, once you kind of have broken out of that literalism and see a lot of this stuff as metaphor, archetype, and all that stuff, there's a lot of freedom there. So does he, for the LDS Church, I think Thomas S. Monson is the only person who's the one person in charge of it all and has whatever keys that, people want to pretend.
That's kind of how I do it.
I have no problem with that.
Yeah, on the specific question, within the Mormon Church, I don't mind that he says only the president of the church can call an apostle. Only the apostles have the authority to perform these functions. Those keys, only a bishop has the right to, approve whether or not this ordinance or something does within their thing. But whether or not that is what I believe the priesthood of God is, or if that's just the scaffolding and the different things that have come along with the Mormon story, and I use myth, not in that it's complete crap, non-factual, but yet I tend to, not claim exclusive priesthood for Mormonism. I just haven't been able to go that way.
The LDS Church, he's the only guy. I don't think my next door neighbor is the president of the church, so or the guy down the street, or Warren Jeffs, or anybody else. So, yeah, I could say yes.
How satisfying or unsatisfying are Brian and I on that?
No, I think you've got to the heart of it, which is that you would have to basically define what all of these things mean, and there's no clear definition for what all of this means. And so
I know the person on the other side of the desk may be attaching different baggage to it, but that's not my problem.
Exactly. I think he wants me to go to the temple, and he really doesn't want the complicated answers.
I've tried to have these conversations a couple of times with like a bishop or stake president. This is just my experience. They get really uncomfortable, and I mean, they express how much they love me and how much they know the church is true. And I just kind of have to let it go and go, yeah, I love you too. You're a great bishop. If there's anything I can do to help you out, you're the one in charge of the ward, and I respect that. So there you go, right back into this whole like priesthood keys, or was Joseph Smith a prophet? Yeah, he founded a major American religion. I mean, if that's not a prophet, I don't know what is a prophet. You can get into all these kind of you can attach your own meaning to these, but the questions, to me, are much more open-ended than they sound, especially if you want to assume that you have to believe, you have to attach the same meaning as somebody else in order for your answer to have be an answer of integrity.
I think the last couple of minutes will really clarify things for a lot of people. So I appreciate you guys taking the time to let me ask all these follow-up questions.
Oh, no, man. You know, I have, again, it's so weird with all of our stops and starts. I have no clue how long it's going to be, but I know we're blowing past our normal time. But hopefully people will be interested because, you know, honestly, as I look at, we've done some fun and really interesting podcasts, I think, here. But this one might be the one that's probably more, you know, on people's brains than any other, so hopefully they'll forgive us for going 2.5 hours or whatever it might end up being by the time all the splices happen. But so Jeff, thank you for that. And do you have more on your list that you wanted to explore?
Nope, I've checked all the boxes, and now as I look at the time, I've definitely checked all the boxes.
Oh well.
And okay, if I could, Brian, put in a plug, please. The other temple recommend questions, I'll put in a plug for the How to Stay in the LDS Church After a Major Crisis of Faith essay that's available at stayLDS.com.
Okay. Good.
There's a whole section there in that 40-page essay just on how to navigate the temple recommend questions. These aren't the new correct answers. These are just answers from, like we just gave answers, you know, different people's opinions on how you can answer those and have integrity and feel like you're answering them honestly in other ways than is what maybe be traditionally the expectations are.
Cool. And just to let you know, a couple months ago, I interviewed Jim McLaughlin, who's a wonderful friend and a philosophy professor. And he and Tom Kimball, I interviewed him for Mormon Stories, and John has let me know it's going to be one of the next ones that's up. But he and Tom Kimball did a great session in Sunstone on this exact same thing. Tom Kimball says, Jim, you and I have both studied about equally as far as the deconstructing moment. I don't feel my integrity lets me have a temple recommend. Jim came along and says his does. And so in my interview, I let him kind of, you know, riff for 15 minutes on at least his approach to that. So I'll point any listener here to check over at Mormon Stories for when the James McLaughlin interview comes up. That'll be great. And I'll also try to make sure that John posts something to the Sunstone session about that. So on Temple Recommends, there's a little extra help. So thank you, Brian, on that. Did you have any other major points about why, you know, you'd say hang in there a little bit longer, don't go hasty, Brian?
Can't think of anything more now. I think we've hit pretty much all the subjects I could think of, or the angles of looking at it.
Yeah, I've got a couple, but I can share them in the blog comments too. They're definitely on the lower end of my list too. So, okay, here's what I want to say. This podcast began with a full honoring of, we know that the decision is sometimes going to be to leave. I have a feeling when it comes to actual time, we maybe spent more time in this last, you know, put on the brakes, think about it, here's something else to consider thing. So I don't want anybody to think that that was on purpose or whatever. On the other hand, I do sort of think that most of you listening to this who might be in this mode of crisis, I think you do want reasons to stay if you can find them, and if that can work with your integrity. So hopefully this extra time or something said there feels not only fair to everybody who might be thinking the other way, but at least matches up perhaps with something that's in the desire of your heart to find peace in some way. So does that make sense, you guys?
Yes, and I'm glad you said it.
I love everybody regardless of which direction they go.
Exactly, and hopefully that came across, and please call us on it when we sounded like we may not honor your choice or something. So please do comment. But Brian, thank you again for coming back. Joanna, thank you in absentia right now for your great spirit. And Jeff, I can't imagine having this podcast discussion without you. This has been wonderful. Thank you for being so honest about where you're at and just modeling to me, you know, somebody who's on a journey of integrity. No matter where you go, it's clear that you're putting in the time and really really making this a matter of your whole heart. So thank you.
Was a great discussion. I appreciate the forum that this is and the dialogue it is. I've really appreciated it on my own journey, and it's been fun to participate after it being such an important part of my journey. So Thank you.
Well, good. We'll find reasons to get you back. So, but anyway, listeners, thank you. Please join us on the blog. I have a feeling this one might be lots of comments, because this is right where everyone is. I don't know. This is kind of a center of gravity of these online forums issues. So please share your story. Please share things that complicate anything that might have been said here, and then don't feel free to also share your positive ways that you found peace in your life. So looking forward to that, and thank everybody for their support financially for the podcast. Please keep it coming. It really helps. And let me just say goodnight to my panelists and wish you all well.
Yep. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.